What's the most important resource that you have? If you really thought about this deeply, I think you'd come to the same conclusion that Joey and I did. It's time. In our newest book, What's Without Wall Street, The 3 Steps to Financial Freedom Through Passive Income, we talk about how are we tracking that time? What is the thing that we can do to get more of that time back?
That's right. If you've ever been listening to our podcast and thought, man, it would be amazing if I could take all the things that you guys have learned over the last 10 years and just summarize them, put them in some way to easily digest them and take action, that's what this book is all about. You're not going to want to miss it. Go to wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/newbook and get your copy today.
Welcome to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast, your guide to understanding how to get out of the Wall Street rat race and start your own mailbox money lifestyle. Now, don't let these handsome Southern draws fool you. These financial minds are teaching our country to enhance savings, increase cash flow, and create passive income, all without the help of Wall Street. Are you ready to break through? Now here are your hosts, Russ Morgan and Joey Murray.
Welcome. This is the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Your host, Joey, the Italian Stallion Murray, joined as always by Russ, the idea guy, Morgan. Okay, Russ, what's the favorite thing you've ever been called growing up? Nickname.
Oh, the favorite nickname I've been called? Yeah. My only nickname, I don't know if it's something I should share. This is like a secret.
Let us in. Come on.
Well, I was called Skip for a long time.
Okay. There's a reason.
Well, in sixth grade, me and two of my buddies decided to skip school. It was the first time ever, right? You're like, yeah,
if you can get away with it.
Yeah. My sister, I was actually living in a different city. We just moved. It was at the end of the school year so that my mom didn't want to take me out of the school system. My sister was older. So my sister was finishing up high school. Actually, she was graduating that year. So she definitely didn't want to leave the last month and a half of her school. And so I would ride to school with her. And I'm sixth grade. And so she would drop me off at my friend's house. So that way then I would walk to school with them. And, you know, brilliance at six. How old are you in sixth grade? I don't know. Like 12 years
11,
old?
11 yeah.
or 12 years old? My daughter's 12 today. That's crazy. She'd be doing this stupid stuff. But so we had this brilliant idea. We're going to go in the woods. We're going to build forts and just have the best time, right? Well, you know, boys playing in the woods for 2.5 hours, that ran out of fun in a hurry and out of food. And so we're like, oh, well, we can walk to the little gas station and, you know, get some Cokes and Snickers bars or whatever. And so we're rolling down. We get to the place, get all our stuff. I'm sure we had Pop Rocks and everything else you can think of.
Oh, yeah.
And we're walking down this little country road, right? Because I was going to school out in the country. And all of a sudden, this cop pulls up. He's like, what are you three doing? They're like, yeah, we're busted. And so he took us to the police station. The first time I ever skipped school, I get picked up by a cop car. They call my mom. She's got to come to the police station now in this other city, leave her job. And yeah, so for about a year and a half there, I got called Skip because of that by the people who knew me from that.
Very literal nickname, Skip. But at some point, you're actually kind of grateful that that happened, right?
Because oh, yeah. I mean,
if that did not happen, how many more? I mean, you've been Skippy. You'd have been like,
that's right. I didn't skip school after that. Lesson learned, you know, you don't have to ride in a cop car and go to the police station, but once it's okay, yeah. Lesson learned.
So all this being brought up because here you're listening, you're a part of our community, right? You're taking in the Wealth Without Wall Street message and you need to have something to call yourself, right? So obviously Russ was named Skip. I'm the Stallion. You're the listener of the Wealth Without Wall Street show here. What should we call you? Well, this is Russ and I've been talking about.
Well, I know what we're not going to call you. I can tell you that. So Joey and I, a little behind the scenes, Joey and I are flying. We're traveling down to Orlando. We're having this conversation. There's this saying, you know, that 5% of the people think, 10% of the people think they think, and 85% of the people would rather die than think. And this is something that we've had mentors share that with us. And so we're like, okay, well, I mean, maybe, you know, you're listening to the show. You're a thinker. You're part of that 5%.
Yeah.
So what could we do? And Joey, you had one of the worst ideas for names off that 5%.
Okay. I still don't think this is a bad idea. So if you think it's a great idea, you need to let us know. If you think it's a bad idea, you need to let us know. Email us. But okay, you're a thinker, you're in that 5%. So what else is like a 5%? I'm thinking a nickel, right? Is 5% of a dollar, right? And you're also trying to gain wealth. Like you're building wealth, you're trying to get that nickel back, right? You're trying to get money back.
You see where this is going?
So would you be opposed to being called a nickelbacker?
Yes, you would.
I mean, you want to be a nickelbacker.
Nobody wants to be a nickelbacker.
Why is that?
Nickelback doesn't want to be a nickelbacker. I mean, that nickelback, like, I don't know how you can, like, be a band and now become such a big joke. Like, they've had success, but, like, you can't watch, like, College Game Day without seeing, like, signs of saying, like, you know, Nick Saban listens to Nickelback or something. I mean, this is a joke. Nobody wants to be Nickelback.
But you don't have to listen to Nickelback to be called a Nickelbacker, okay?
Well, I'm not going to ever call you a Nickelbacker.
Okay. Well, if you like the name, let us know. If you don't like the name, let us know. Because we need to kind of even this out. Russ and I need to kind of put this thing to bed one way or the other. But that is not what the whole point of our show is today.
Our show is actually bringing on a listener of the show, a member of the community and a client of Wealth Without Wall Street, Tal Simpson. And he's going to share with you some real insight on how we can get deeper into real estate and some of the profit centers that real estate provide to us that maybe you didn't know that you did want to know.
No, you're going to be shocked by the numbers behind the deal when he breaks this down. I mean, things that you never would think are profit centers in anything else are profit centers in real estate. So I don't want to give it all away. Let's jump into this episode with Tal Simpson.
Have you been listening to our podcast and wondering, am I the only person that knows about infinite banking? Or what about the five pillars of Wealth Without Wall Street? How can I learn more? Now is your chance. You can join the community that is learning this across the country.
Go to community.wealthwithoutwallstreet.com where you can access Q&As with all our podcast guests and live group coaching with some of the top experts from across the nation. And yes, I'm throwing in the Stallion and I in that. community.wealthwithoutwallstreet.com. Sign up.
Welcome back. We have Tal Simpson, man. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, now that I'm a podcast veteran, you're lucky that I worked you into my podcasting schedule. But
yeah, I mean, are you like getting like autograph requests from all the local friends and family around?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, when are you going to be on Bigger Pockets? I know that was coming up soon.
Yeah, I'm trying to work them in. Yeah, he's been so busy with all these podcast appearances.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, when you're your own Wealth Without Wall Street, that it kind of circulates, gets around, and we expect hopefully when they invite you on and they ask, you know, hey, who else should we have as a guest? You tell them Russ Morgan. Enjoy
me. Well, okay. You know, Tonto over here just waiting for to be brought along.
This is an episode, if it's all right, I want to kind of take your experience and look at more numbers and some of the profit centers, if you will, of what real estate provides. Because if you're not a real estate investor, maybe you don't understand all of these things and these terms may not be as familiar to you. So again, you're very new on this. This isn't something that you've been doing for 50 years. So I think you can speak more the language of somebody who is just starting out. So I want to talk a little bit about that and kind of get your opinion of what those five profit centers are.
Yeah, so this is, you know, we can talk about all the mindset and the emotional sappy reasons for why I wanted to get involved in real estate. It was once I started realizing the power of how much money you can make in real estate that really got me fired up.
Capitalism.
Yes.
Money talks.
Greedy real estate investors. But yeah, it's the more that I've learned about the financial aspect of real estate, the more I see why the wealthiest people in the world own a lot of real estate. And if you've read any of Kiyosaki's books, this will resonate with you. But really, that the reasons, if I were to boil why real estate is such a attractive investment and asset class down to three things, it's debt, taxes, and inflation.
Ooh.
And these are, you know,
those are terms usually looked at.
Those are scary words for the, you know, average consumer. But I think, as you'll see, we dive into these five ways real estate pays you, you'll see what I mean.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I mean, Joey, if I came to you and I said, I got a great idea for you, here's my proposition. You ready? It's gonna include debt, taxes, and inflation. How excited are you?
Yeah, chances of that being like a positive experience are pretty
yeah, strong. Sign me up. Debt, taxes, and inflation.
I mean, this is our government talking to us right yeah. now. All right, so let's dig into that. You maybe want to know more. Help me understand how debt, taxes, and inflation help me as a real estate investor.
All right, so the five ways real estate can pay you, and again, this is, I'm coming from my perspective. I'm buying residential real estate, income properties. I'm not talking about flipping houses.
Long-term buy and hold.
Long-term buy and hold.
Absolutely.
In a typical house that you're buying, looks like what?
All right, for easy math, I'm going to say $100,000 house okay. that'll rent for $1,000 a month.
All right, perfect.
That's kind of a good, not only is it easy math, but I think that's a very, that would be a good,
that's a good deal.
Be a good purchase.
That fits that 1%.
1% rule.
Yeah, all right. So you said there's five things. What are those?
All right, five? I'll list them first and then we'll go back and dive in.
All right, perfect. Tell them what you're going to tell them.
Cash flow. That's the obvious one. That's the one that I think everybody focuses on.
Right.
Appreciation is the other one.
Right.
So cash flow being the difference after all expenses are paid.
This is the money. This is that mailbox money that's coming into my pocket after I paid everything.
Appreciation means the value of the property grows with time.
Right.
Depreciation. So we've got appreciation and depreciation. Okay. What depreciation refers to is the tax write-off that you get with real estate. So because real estate is property, just like you can write off, you know, a computer for your business, depreciated over 5 years on your taxes, real estate is depreciable too. The fourth one I like to call amortization, because it's a long fancy word, but really it's making principal payments on your mortgage.
You're just paying down the debt.
You're gaining equity by paying down what you owe.
Right.
And then the fifth one is inflation. And that one takes a little bit of mind twisting. We all know what inflation is, but how it makes you money in real estate is fascinating and interesting.
Well, which is amazing, because inflation is one of those things that, as we see the price of goods getting more expensive, we see inflation as a negative thing. Most people don't know, but if you go do a little research, you realize the price of goods going up is the result of more money printing, right? The more our government, more the Fed prints,
Wait, Russ, are you saying that the government can print money?
Yeah, I mean, technically, they don't even print it anymore. They're too lazy. They just
put it add in, a zero on a
screen. Just click a button.
Yeah, you click buttons now. But yes, that is how we create inflation. The more money in the economy makes the price of goods go up. So,
which I've heard you call it before, termites in your wallet.
Yeah, it definitely is eroding the purchasing power of our dollar. So I'm interested in how inflation will help me as well. So which one are we going to start with?
All right, let's go with cash flow, because that's the fun one.
I mean, start where the money is.
That's what it's all about, right?
Let's get into cash flow.
All right, so cash flow is what you have left over after you get rental income in, you've got expenses to pay, whatever's left over is cash flow. So
what would you say that number is on that same $100,000?
All right, so for typical $100,000 house that's rented for $1,000 a month, a quick rule of thumb that I use, so you've got operating expenses, which are taxes, insurance, property management, if you hire a third-party manager, which we do, vacancy allowance, and then repairs.
Right.
And so all of those together, average every, you know, if you have one property, it could vary widely, but over a portfolio, on average, I found that that's about 40% of your gross income. If you're just going to use a ballpark rule of thumb.
So $400 to $1,000 is going toward overhead.
Yeah, and some of that is just, okay, I'm going to set some money aside for repairs or capital expenses.
Because we know it's going to happen at some point, so right. You need to have a reserve balance for it.
Yeah, a roof will cost $5,000, but only come around every 20, 30 years. And then, again, like we use leverage, we use debt to buy and hold our real estate. So your debt payment, and again, I'm making the numbers I'm assuming here, which I think anybody will, I don't think anybody challenged me that this is over aggressive or not conservative enough. I'm going to say you make a 25% down payment and you're getting a 30-year fixed loan at 5%,
okay.
Which, by the way, I'm refinancing a rental property right now, and it's at 3.875%.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah.
So 5% conservative estimate. You can put 20% down too. Sometimes you can even put less, but I'm going to say go with a little bit bigger down payment. So under those numbers, your debt payment's also going to come out to be about 40% of your gross income.
Okay, so now we got 40 for operating expenses, 40 for debt repayment. That's $800 of our $1,000.
Yep, 20% cash flow.
Okay.
So can we invent a rule called the 40-40-20 rule right now?
Okay.
I mean, let's copyright it right now, okay, before we get off the show.
So 40-40-20, you're making $200 a month cash flow.
All right. So in essence, and what the example you gave is if I bought a $100,000 house, I put $25,000 down to get it, and I'm making $200 a month. So $2,400 on $25,000.
Yep.
Stallion, give me the quick math on that. It's about 8%, 9%.
That's not something I can do in my head.
Well, good thing that I wrote this down ahead of time.
Oh,
well, good.
What's the math on that?
That's 9.6% cash on cash return.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Very solid. Very good.
All right.
Anybody could be happy with that.
By the way, I love when you put
me happy with that. It's under 12%.
That's right. Because you're guaranteed to compound 12% a year in the stock market, so why would you settle for 9.6%?
But also, that's only on cash flow. So that's only
one
of the four profit centers.
That's,
okay. Well, there's five, but...
Oh,
okay.
I'm sorry, there's four more is what I meant to say.
That's why he's not doing the math. That's why I did it ahead of time.
Thank you.
Well, he brought out his calculator to be able to figure out that.
I just took my shoe off and looked at my toes.
All right, profit center number two. Move on. Asset appreciation. So on average, nationwide over the last 30 years, I looked this up, that the average annual appreciation of real estate is 3.4%.
Okay.
And that's about right. It's something that kind of tracks inflation. Now, here in Birmingham, actually the last couple of years, it's probably been more like 8 to 10% a year. It's hot market.
But, well, and that's where you're buying all your rental properties right now, here in Birmingham area.
That's right. We're lucky here that investing in your backyard works out. If you live in a much more expensive market, you're probably not going to be able to get
these numbers. You're in Colorado, you're looking somewhere else.
These are Birmingham numbers, okay? These are not Southern California numbers.
Sure.
So I'm going to plug in 3% appreciation.
All right.
Over the long haul, I think it's a very safe bet. So 3% appreciation on a $100,000 house, $3,000. You think, oh, that's a 3% return. Well, no, because you've got $25,000 in the deal, not $100,000. So a 3%, you get to enjoy the appreciation on the full $100,000, not just your 25%. So you go $3,000 of appreciation divided by $25,000 down payment. That's a 12%.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So add that to 9.6%. That's two. What are we? 21.6% return already, and this is in year one.
Just 1 year, yeah.
This is 1 year, and I'm not even trying to account for compounded appreciation. Like, what if that $103,000 then appreciates another 3%?
Right, because if you think about it, I mean, just using the rule of 72, that tells me it's going to double in 24 years.
Yep.
So my $100,000 house is going to be worth $200,000 in 24 years.
And that's probably about right if you think back to what the how long the mid 90s.
Yes,
that's probably about right. So profit center number three. This is a fun one. Depreciation.
Yeah, this is going to take a little bit more explanation.
Okay, so it may not be a surprise to you that you can depreciate.
I think people
business,
know that
real estate, you know, on your tax return. The standard, and I've got some cool nuggets to throw in here too that'll boost this number even more. But the standard depreciation of real estate is a 27.5 year amortization, which works out to you can write off 3.6% of the improvements to the land. So for a $100,000 house, you know, maybe the land's worth $20,000, the building's worth $80,000.
Right.
That's pretty reasonable standard breakdown there. So if you're just doing standard depreciation over 27.5 years, I've got 3.6% of that $80,000 improved value. I'm trying to read my chicken scratch here. It's $2,909 a year of depreciation in year one. So then you have to apply.
Repeat that number one more time.
Okay.
$80,000. $2,200 and how much?
$2,909.
So, if my income is $2,400, right? Net income, right? After my debt repayment.
You're talking the cash flow.
My cash flow. My cash flow is $2,400. And then I get to turn around on my tax return and put a $2,900 negative on there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I see that's an easy math problem for you there.
Yeah. Joe, you get that one?
I took my other shoe off, I got it.
That's called a paper loss, but a real gain.
Okay.
And so I just, for the sake of plugging a number, I said, let's go 35% tax rate combined federal and state. So if you're writing off $2,909 at 35% tax rate, that is, at least in this scenario, $1,018 of actual dollars, not tax write-off, but you're saving, because this would be at your marginal tax rate. So that is, so $1,000, $1,018 divided by your $25,000 investment, that's another 4.1% ROI.
Okay, so for adding them up, for those keeping track at home,
we got 9.6 cash flow.
Right.
We got 12% appreciation.
Okay.
We got 4.1% ROI.
25.7.
On depreciation. Okay. There you go. All right. Now, here's the cool nugget. This, say what you want about our president and what he says in tweets, but he's a real estate investor.
Right.
So, you know that tax plan, you know what it's going to be. There are various, and by the way, the best resource to hear what I'm talking about right now, Tom Wheelwright.
Yeah.
Robert Kiyosaki's CPA.
Yeah, it's another great podcast. I listen to the Wealth Ability Show.
Yeah. And he's got a book called Tax Free Wealth.
Right.
I think he's done a couple of editions of that. Definitely check that out. So in the new tax plan, one of the many benefits is that you can now apply what's called bonus depreciation to used property. So that includes a rental house. It's used property. And when you combine that with something called a cost segregation study, the returns on that profit center just multiply. So a cost segregation study is basically you look at a building. So the IRS lets you use a 27.5 year amortization on the full building. But if you were to break it down into its components, like you've got drywall and light fixtures and copper wiring,
VAC,
carpets, whatever.
When you break, a lot of those items are on like a 7 year.
Yeah, if you think about it, brick is not going to break down as fast as my HVAC unit that breaks down every 6 months.
Exactly. Especially in
that's just
August,
yours, Russ.
Do I get to accelerate mine on 6 months?
I think you can write the whole thing off.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's not what, I won't mention Train's name on here, but that's not what they said.
Yeah. The unnamed HVAC company named Train. So the cost segregation study allows you to accelerate the depreciation of a good chunk of your house. And Tom Wheelwright says 20 to 30% of a building can be accelerated, the depreciation.
Over the seven-year time frame.
Over a seven-year, I think there are some stuff is 7 years, some is 10. There might even be a five-year category. Now, the problem up until, at least my own personal recent discovery, this has been something that larger commercial buildings have done, but it doesn't really make sense for a smaller single family house because
the cost of doing it.
You have to hire a special kind of engineer and a CPA to do it, and it might cost like 10 grand to do it. And if you're talking about $100,000 rental property, that doesn't make sense. However, again, Tom Wheelwright, shout out here, listened to his podcast one day and he said, oh no, you can do that. There is a website, a company that will do that for you on smaller residential properties. I believe,
do tell.
Put in the show notes, I believe it's called KBKG.com.
KBKG.com.
And that's an acronym for probably some partners' names in an accounting firm.
Okay. But
you can go online. I've done this, so I feel confident enough to say it on air. You can go in and enter your property information and, you know, how big is it? What kind of flooring? Is there a fence in the backyard? And they will spit out a cost segregation breakdown for you, and it costs $400. So I've actually done this to try it out. I used it. It was actually a little bit cheaper than $100,000 property, and still worked. So you can now do this on single family homes. And you know, maybe not like a $30,000 house, but certainly a $100,000 house, it makes sense.
Well, see, so that for if you're not a real estate investor, and if you have a W-2 job, I mean, that you're just an employee, you're not a business owner, you don't see a lot of the write-offs. Now, the standard deduction just got increased, so we get a little more write-off per se. But this is where Kiyosaki talks about the different quadrants. And he says why the E quadrant, the employee quadrant, ends up paying the most, and where the business owner, the true business owner, where they own a business and don't work inside of it, and the investor are literally paying the least amount of taxes because they're taking advantage of things that are in the tax code, like depreciation.
And another thing he says is there are three kinds of income: ordinary income, portfolio income, passive income. Passive income is zero taxes. This is what he's talking about, depreciation. So when you combine a cost segregation, which is now available for just a standard single family home.
That's really cool.
And I'm sure there are other companies that will do this, but this is, again, Tom Wheelwright says, check it out. I check it out. With bonus depreciation, which allows you to write off the full deductible amount in year one. And Tom Wheelwright gives a 20 to 30% of the value is you're able to write off in the first year. So I use 20% of the $80,000 building that we're talking about here. Let me check my numbers here. If you were to do this, you're talking about a $16,000 depreciation paper loss in year one, which apply that to your 35% tax rate. That's $5,600 divided by 25,000. That's 22.4% return on investment.
Wow. So this is where,
But just for anybody keeping up, we're at 48.1% return with all the things you just mentioned.
In year one. I feel like that's pretty solid. 48% return. Get anybody excited?
Yeah. I mean, unless it's like a return home on a airplane. Yeah. that's my percentage of landing. They're coming back. Yeah. But no, that's amazing. All right. So
these are value bombs. You're dropping value.
So even like take out cost segregation and bonus depreciation, I've got just your standard depreciation tax benefit of an extra 4% return on your money.
So let's dive into the fourth one. So we're heading towards five. So far we've done three: cash flow, appreciation, depreciation, and now you start getting into debt.
Debt.
Okay, so let's talk about
debt. It's a four-letter word.
Yeah.
It is a four-letter word.
It is.
Amortization, which is just paying down the principal balance of your loan. So on this loan that I concocted for this scenario, 5% rate, $75,000 loan. In the first year.
Which is the worst year.
Which is the worst year.
Right, first is the worst.
The average, if you just take the midpoint of the first year, it's about $98 a month principal pay down, which doesn't sound that alone is not that exciting, but that's a $1,176 in the first year, which is another 4.7% return on your $25,000 down payment.
So roughly $1,200 of the $4,800 I'm paying is going toward principal pay down.
Yeah. Right.
That first year. Okay. And so that's money. I mean, because that we didn't pay for it. Who paid for that?
The renters paid us. Absolutely. And again, that's year one.
Yeah.
Year 30. Yeah, year 30. It's
they're paying it all.
Yeah, I didn't do that math, but you can imagine.
And in your personal rental properties, right? So you came on the last show, we talked about going from zero to 64, and your model is all long-term single-family residential properties is what you're acquiring. When you say long-term for you as a real estate investor, what does that mean?
Well, I've been doing this for a year and 9 months.
But what's your strategy to hold?
I don't even know. Like a long time. A long time. There's another, we could do another show on long-term strategies, but there's something called a 1031 exchange.
Right.
1031 being the section of the IRS code that allows for like-kind exchange. And it basically lets you, if you sell a property that has appreciated, and if you've depreciated the cost of that, you're going to have to recapture that when you sell. That would normally be a capital gain. But through a 1031 exchange, if you follow fairly straightforward procedure, you can sell that, roll the money that you make from that into a bigger deal and defer taxes. So really, you could defer until you die.
And then the current rules, if you die with a piece of real estate, the person who inherits it gets to that step up in basis. So then all of that potential recapture goes away.
Right. Okay. So when you're talking long term, you may not hold a particular property forever.
But you're looking at this as holding the gain. So when we talk about life insurance and the use of life insurance and the way personally, borrowing against life insurance policies, and people will say, oh, well, if I ever lapse that policy or ever cancel that policy, then I have to go back and pay all the taxes on it. Very similar to the real estate.
Yeah.
If I sell it and I don't roll those gains into a new property, I'll end up paying tax on it. But just like with the life insurance policy, when you die, the step up in basis happens. You don't end up paying any of that potential gain that happened in there. Very similar, right?
Exactly. So that's how the long-term play can come into play.
All right. So speaking of long-term, you get the last one, the fifth one here, we're going to talk about, and we mentioned termites in your wallet. So Walk us through inflation.
All right. Inflation.
How does that benefit me?
All right. So you take out a loan, do a 30-year fixed loan. Let's say I think in this scenario, the payment was like $402.
Yep.
Right.
So $402 is your payment in month one. What's your payment in month 359?
402.
It's the same.
Okay. So 30 years. What does.
Unless greedy mortgage guys like Joe over here get a hold of.
Right.
That was my past life. Come on. I've moved on.
Yes. The mortgage, if it's a 30-year fix, it's going to be the same if I ever refinance it.
So 30 years from now, if you had the opportunity to pay for things based on pricing today, would you take that deal?
Yeah. Every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Toyota Tundra I bought last year would be a fraction of what its cost was.
So like we said, 40% roughly of your income from a property goes towards your debt payment. So you're talking about 40% of the cost. And really, you know, half of the expenses on the property are fixed for 30 years. Meanwhile, the purchasing power of those dollars is getting eroded by, let's call it 3%. I think that's more than generous. 3% inflation over 30 years. So in year one, this is kind of hard to calculate. I need one of your fancy calculators to do it properly. But year one, 12 months of $400 a month payment is $4,800 a year.
Right.
If you apply 3% inflation over 30 years, that should be 11,000. Oh, I didn't write this one down. 11,600 something for the same property. If you didn't have fixed term debt, if it rose with inflation, you'd be paying $6,851 more in year 30 than year one. Let that sink in.
All right. So, and another way that my brain thinks about that same inflation. So one, the purchasing power of that dollar has been eroded. So it doesn't feel like a $400 a month payment anymore. It feels like a fraction of that. Right. So if we did it in reverse, right. If we said, what is a $4,000 or $4,800 payment or $400 a month payment feel like in 30 years? It feels like probably $100.
Yeah. And meanwhile, rent, just like everything else, rises with inflation.
Right. So now my rent that started out at $1,000 a month, I know in 24 years, if we're keeping at that 3% because of the Rule 72, that my rent is no longer 1,000, my rent's 2,000 a month.
That's right. Now, expenses will rise with inflation too, but a huge percentage of your expense is fixed for 30 years.
Exactly. So when we start looking at a profit margin of 20%, right, if we had 80% going toward expenses, then that number is going to keep growing just because inflation is helping us in relationship to what my monthly payment is. And this is where sometimes you hear us on the podcast, we talk about, you know, hey, we want to be in control of our dollars. And sometimes you hear Joey and I talk about why maybe paying off our houses are not a great idea.
Right.
And this is exactly one of those tools when you say, how is inflation helping me? Because when I need my dollars to be at work and earning and keeping up with this, and as my mortgage payment continues to be the same over 30 years, I can actually benefit. And if I'm in rental property, my rents are increasing, but yet my payment for the mortgage is staying the same.
And this is why a lot of investors with a lot of wealthy investors who have a lot of money, they don't even care about cash flow.
Right.
Because of the inflation hedge, the tax benefits, and the gradual appreciation of the asset over time.
Well, back in the early 80s, and this is where Kiyosaki was getting into it, there were some rules that govern LLCs and other things where literally the tax benefits, they were buying properties that were negative cash flowing that had so much tax benefits when in the early 80s, the tax rates were pretty high too, 50%.
Yeah.
Where it was, they were actually buying property to lose money on purpose because they were gaining from a tax perspective. And that's where, I don't know, most people don't know this about life insurance, but where you used to be able to put as much money as you wanted to into life insurance. But when all those rules changed with the LLCs with tax for real estate, all of those real estate investors for a short period of time were advised by the tax attorneys to flood all that cash flow into life insurance. And because of that whole kind of loophole got shut down, and that's why we have limits to how much money we can put on in a policy in any given year.
Yep.
Well, so man, this has been amazing. I knew you started out saying we would be shocked by this information. I can say this is very eye-opening to me.
Debt, taxes, and inflation.
I mean, I would have never thought those things were on our side.
Yes, these are good things.
So thank you for sharing this with us. Any last thoughts about these from a profit center perspective in terms of how you're viewing this in your own portfolio?
I invest for cash flow, so I make that the priority. And I strongly recommend.
Let's say we're going into a recession. I mean, I don't think this is like, I'm not a prophet. I'm just opening my ears. We're heading into recession. You're still buying properties right now.
Absolutely.
Why, if you're focused on cash flow, do you have to wonder or worry about that coming recession?
I think cash flow is what keeps your head above water, even in troubled times. If you're counting on appreciation, you can get screwed because leverage works against you too.
Right.
If it goes down 10% and you're levered at 4-1,
right,
you know, that's going to work against you. That's why if you invest for cash flow, you'll be able to hold on to your properties. And
yeah, your cash flow may go from $200 to $50. But as long as you're positive or not underwater, then you can ride out the appreciation part of that.
Exactly. And during the good times, you just enjoy the cash flow.
That's right. Well, Tyler, this is amazing. If you're not already a member of our community, make sure you dive in there. We do have a segment just for real estate. We call it
Biggest Pockets. Biggest
Pockets. Tyler's a member. You can hopefully connect with him and others who are focused on ways to grow their wealth without Wall Street within the real estate environment. And as always, we thank you for listening to the show.
This has been the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show to break free of the Wall Street mindset and begin building wealth on your own terms in places you understand so that your wealth will never run dry. See you next episode.